Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello everyone and welcome to this episode of Hidden Histories with the AHRC New Generation Thinkers Scheme. For this podcast, I spoke to Dr. Jonathan Healy. Jonathan is a historian of the 17th century and he is working on a book at the moment which encapsulates the entire century and all of the shifts and turns and twists and various kings and various social shifts that happen, the civil war, a plague, a fire. So there's so much to talk about, and Jonathan amazingly manages to encapsulate this entire century in a gripping and exciting conversation for this podcast. And I found it absolutely fascinating to listen to him and listen to his energy burst forth. And he tells the story of the 17th century with such lyricism. And it feels like an exciting period of history that I think that you will all feel equally as engaged with as I did. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Jonathan Healy, welcome to Hidden Histories. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure. It's lovely to be on. Lovely to see you, even if it is on this kind of weird sort of witchcraft, electronic witchcraft.
So we're going to talk about the 17th century and trying to talk about the 17th century in a nutshell, because this is the focus of your forthcoming book. And you, because you so kindly sent me the proposal for your book, I have read a bit about it. You have amazingly managed to condense a huge amount of information into one book. And so we're going to try and talk about some of these themes within the scope of the podcast. And the 17th century itself was, you know, I had some understanding of it before and I've worked with you before on it, but it was an incredibly tumultuous century. I mean, there were various kings, a civil war, the Republic, it was a rise in the print press. So let's just start at the beginning for people who aren't quite so familiar with it. James Stuart inherits the throne, and that is the start of the Stuart dynasty and how we, you know, perceive the century as a whole. So what was happening around this period? What about the people? What were the major movements going on, and how did the country look around the ascension of James Stuart?
Right, it's a great series of questions, but as you say, it's a sort of, you know, it is always a challenge to kind of squeeze all these kind of things into one book or indeed one podcast. There's about 5.5 million English people in the middle of the 17th century, about 4 million at the start. They mostly live in the countryside. They all believe in God, mostly. A proportion of them can read, a rising proportion of them can read. And they were absolutely, you know, they were absolutely not stupid peasants, as sometimes people think. So what we're looking at in England in the 17th century is an exceptionally complicated society, and one which is going through a series of really, really quite drastic changes. Those changes including economic change. The economy is developing, it's becoming more sophisticated. There's an increasing number of people who are involved in industry, involved in trade, all that kind of thing. It's also becoming more religiously complicated, I think it's fair to say. Lots of people are familiar with the Reformation in the Tudor period. Let's say we're in 1603, James I comes down from Scotland to take up his throne in England. One of the first things he's presented associated with is a petition by these people called Puritans. Puritans being people who believe that the Elizabethan church settlement, the Reformation church settlement, hasn't gone far enough and there's more that needs to be done. But at the same time, within 2 years, he's also faced with a conspiracy by some of his Catholic subjects, what we call the Gunpowder Plot. So the religious landscape is complicated. And it's complicated enough in the reign of James I. In some ways, under James I, it becomes slightly more settled. But then as the century goes on, it becomes even more complicated, firstly by the rise of a group within the English church which pushes for more kind of complicated ceremonies. These are people which are associated with Charles I, who is James's son, and his Archbishop of Canterbury, William Laud. But then, of course, you get the Civil War and the whole thing blows up and you get the development of loads and loads of these kind of small radical religious sects, of which the most important are people like the Quakers. And by 1660, there's as many Quakers in England as there are Catholics. So in terms of religion, the you're sort of picking things up from the Reformation, you're kind of mixing it up again and you're throwing out all this kind of much greater religious diversity by the end of the period. So there's that. One of the other things is that it's an increasingly news-driven culture. One of the most important innovations in 17th century England, although it wasn't an English innovation, it was imported from abroad, was the periodical newspaper. And, you know, from the 1620s, when there's suddenly a big war on the continent, you get these news books which deal with foreign news, because that's all they're allowed to do. And then the Civil War happens in the 1640s, and suddenly you get regular newspapers being published in London and in Oxford, and they kind of create this and they cater towards this thirst for regular news. It has to be said their relationship with, you know, factual truth, whatever that is somewhat variable, as it perhaps is today. But it creates a very, very different news environment where ordinary people, particularly in the capital, particularly in London, and particularly amongst the sort of middling sort of people, are thirsty for information, thirsty for politics, thirsty for all kinds of new things. And that's just to scratch the surface.
Yeah, I mean, it must be, so, you know, as you began with talking about religion, and I think that is, it's obviously an extremely conflicting period for both Protestants and Catholics, and especially when you have James coming and inheriting the throne, but he comes from his mother was Catholic, obviously, Mary, Queen of Scots. And so it's a really complicated dynamic between the suspicion that he's going to empathise and sympathise with the Catholic proportion of England, but then there's obviously the Protestants that he's trying to keep on side as well, and as you say, that emerges within the Gunpowder Plot. I mean, so was there a particularly strong social hierarchy at this point? So, you know, was there a large sense of poor versus wealthy? So around this time, am I right in thinking that the group, the Levellers, emerged, and they represented this dynamic, this interplay between the wealthy and the poor in England? Who were the Levellers?
Yes, I mean, loads of interesting questions there. I'm actually going to take things back a little bit to one of the first things I said, which is about population. And the population of England is growing in this period, right up to the middle of the 17th century. That may seem like a slightly kind of weird lead into the Levellers, but if you think about it this way, what that's doing is creating more pressure on resources. And some people do very, very well out of that. The sort of middling sort, the wealthy farmers, the yeomans, the William Shakespeares, if you like, or even to a point, the sort of the Cromwell family, although Oliver Cromwell himself actually is sort of, you know, is struggling a bit financially. Those groups are doing very, very well. But society is, as one historian puts it very evocatively, filling up from the bottom. There's an increasing number of people in really quite severe poverty. So I think one of the ways that we should think about the 17th century is it's a period where amongst ordinary people, so amongst peasants, shopkeepers, townspeople, the wealthy are becoming wealthier and the poor are becoming really, really poor. And that creates a lot of really kind of dangerous challenges for society as a whole. The Levellers do fit into this, but in slightly weird ways. What the Levellers were was they were a group of political and, to an extent, religious radicals who developed in the 1640s in London, and who also put down quite significant roots in the Parliamentarian Army and the New Model Army. And that then led to, you know, when the Parliamentarians won the Civil War, they then had to decide what to do with the the political settlement. And, you know, this in itself is an amazing thing about the period, because instead of just going, well, obviously we just go back to what we had before, they actually start to think, well, is there a better way? Is there a way that we can improve the constitution? And as part of those discussions, the levellers kind of really sort of barge in, if you like, to the discussions about the future of the country. And they argue not just that the people as represented in Parliament are sovereign, they're where power comes from, but the sovereignty of the people overrides Parliament, and that it should be a check on Parliament. It's a very interesting constitutional question. You know, you get in 1642, there's basically a debate between royalists and parliamentarians. The royalists think that power comes from God. The parliamentarians, broadly speaking, think that power comes from the people, but that power is represented through Parliament. But the levellers, who include a lot of people who have been extremely badly treated by Parliament. One of them, John Lilburn, gets thrown in prison by the House of Lords. So they, you know, they're quite cynical about the power of Parliament. They want to create another set of checks against arbitrary power, not just from the King, but from Parliament. And the way they want to do that is, well, there's two things, really. Firstly, something, you know, very radical, which is they want to create a set of constitutional principles which will basically restrict the freedom of Parliament. So a written constitution, if you like, or at least written constitutional principles. But secondly, they want to make sure that the vote is as widely used as possible and is widely available as possible. So they call for reform of the franchise. In 1600, only a small proportion of the even English men are able to vote. There's also only a small proportion of elections are actually contested. In most cases, the local kind of bigwigs basically just get together and say, we've decided that this guy shall be our MP, and there's nought you can do about it. The levellers are arguing that the franchise should be much, much more widely available. Not necessarily everyone, although some of the levellers, famously an army officer called Thomas Rainborough, argues that, you know, all men should be able to vote. Most levellers are content with just saying that the vote goes to people who pay poor rates, so they pay for taxes towards the poor. So that whole kind of argument, it's about it's about restricting Parliament, but it's also about vesting sovereignty in the people, something which we sort of take for granted today, but in the 17th century was hugely contested. Now, I said that the levellers occupied a sort of fairly complicated position in this social hierarchy, and the reason I say that is that the levellers were very much a London-based organisation. And they were very much, they drew their strength from the London middle, I'm going to say middle class, but I'm going to say it carefully because it's a controversial term. Other people prefer sort of middle sort, which is more contemporary. But they are wealthy, youngish, usually men, although actually had a large amount of women who supported them, literate, and people who have, you know, done apprenticeships. They're not the absolute poorest, which itself is quite interesting. The poor, on the other hand, you could say that they were represented by other radical groups, one of which is very, very famous. Well, two of which are very, very famous. The first of which is very, very famous for representing the poor, the second of which isn't. The first is the Diggers, who were a small group of basically kind of rural communists who set up a camp in Surrey, of all places, and tried to basically abolish private property and cultivate the land in common before the locals got a bit peeved about it and called in the army to basically move them on. But the second group who represent the poor are in some ways more interesting, and that's the Quakers. The Quakers were obviously as a religious group, but the radicalism of the Quakers is in many ways sort of even more important and certainly more lasting. And that relates in part to ideas about salvation, because the Quakers believed that, you know, if you accepted the inner light, then you would be saved. And that in itself was a very sort of radical statement, because it meant that, you know, even the poorest person, and that and they very much did include women. You know, the Quakers were much more kind of into gender equality than virtually anyone else in the period. That gave a much stronger role for really, really poorer folk. So in a sense, they really represent the, I mean, you know, they had supporters from across the spectrum, but they were more appealing, if you like, to the really poor than say the Leveller movement.
Gosh, so there is this complete mix of political and social groups going on at this period. So you've got the ardent royalists who believe that the monarchy and the king is representative of God, and so you've got these guys at the top, and then you've got the Quakers all the way at the bottom, and then somewhere in the middle is kind of the Levellers, then there's the parliamentarians. Because when you think about the Civil War, and I think when most people think about the Civil War, they think there are these two groups. There's the Royalists, the Cavaliers, and the parliamentarians, the Roundheads. Yet there are actually all of these subgroups at play as well. So this all comes to a really messy head in the Civil War, and all of these groups kind of come in on one another, and it all comes to a big climactic ending, and we end up with a republic. How does that play out, and how does that shift things for the next part of the 17th century?
Yeah, well, I suppose just to sort of go back to what you were saying a second ago, you do have all these groups, but to an extent they all kind of, interesting, they all come out of the Civil War. The Civil War kind of happens because, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but it happens because the social elite can't sort out their difficulties. And as a result of that, these sort of cracks appear and you get these more radical ideas, which sort of, I mean, you know, they have precedence, definitely, but they appear out of the political breakdown. So there were no Levellers in 1639, although there were people who might have had Levellerish ideas. But then you get the chaos of the Civil War, and then that leads to the growth of sort of radical democratic ideas. The radicalism comes out of the political breakdown rather than the political breakdown coming out of the radicalism. So in 1649, the monarchy is abolished. The House of Lords is abolished as being, the Parliament declares it to be useless and dangerous, although one of their more radical members quips that the House of Lords was useless but not dangerous. And you then get a period of 4 years of rule by a single House of Commons, the Rump Parliament, followed by a short period of rule by so-called saints, where there was 140 MPs basically were picked by the army to rule England. That didn't really solve anything. So eventually you got a system of kind of, let's say, quasi-monarchical system under Oliver Cromwell, under the Protectorate. And the Republic, A, fails in that in 1660, Charles II, the son of Charles I, comes to the throne. So it's in the short term, it's not a successful experiment. It's also often accused of being insufficiently radical, in that, you know, there are all these groups like Levellers and they're pushing for one thing, and there are groups like Quakers who end up getting persecuted by members of the Republic government. And so it doesn't kind of, you know, it doesn't fulfill the potential that it maybe had. And, you know, especially from the point of view of some of the religious radicals who actually believe that the apocalypse is upon us and the end times are upon us and Jesus is going to come back and rule. And instead they get Oliver Cromwell followed by even worse Charles II. So it's often criticised as being, you know, insufficiently radical. But on the other hand, I mean, three things that are quite significant, even if they are short-lived. The first of which is that it basically kind of toys with the idea of a written constitution. So in 1653, the army produces this document called the Instrument of Government, which basically sets up the Protectorate Constitution. And it's a written constitution. It's the first written constitution in the English-speaking world. And obviously is a kind of, you know, in some ways is a sort of, you know, forerunner of the American Constitution. And, you know, one could note that in the UK today, we are relatively unusual that we don't have a written constitution. So, you know, who was on the right side of history there? Was it the Republic, or was it the Royalists? So that's the first thing. The second thing is that they look to create a wider religious toleration than there had been before. Now, I'm not saying that this is perfect in by any stretch of the imagination. It was still a pretty bad time to be a Catholic, and in theory, the Book of Common Prayer was banned, but there was certainly an assumption that, or there was certainly provision for much wider debate of religious issues under the Republic, which, you know, is in itself a sort of, let's say, forward-looking thing. But the third thing is perhaps the more subtle one. The revolution itself, the regicide, had been a deeply unpopular move by a very, very small number of people connected to the Army High Command. There is absolutely no debate that the vast majority of people in England at the time, let alone Scotland or Ireland, there's no debate about whether or not they wanted a regicide. The vast majority of people didn't. But the regicide, nonetheless, took place in the name of the people. Although this is kind of window dressing, actually the very act of doing it that way was important, because it was a recognition, or at least a statement, that sovereignty resides in the people. It doesn't come from God, it comes from the people. And over the course of the 17th century, eventually that became a much more powerful argument, even though the Restoration overthrew it, even though it was a short-term thing. So I think the Republic has a much more, you know, it has much more interest. It's much more important than people allow it. I mean, you know, we sort of think of it as being basically a period where the boring old Puritans cancel football and Christmas and horse racing. But actually there's a liberating radicalism about it, which is important in the longer term development of even things like democracy. It's part of that story, I think.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Yeah, there's a sense of that it has overshadowed monarchical history subsequently. I mean, what was the reception of Charles II with the people? Was he welcome? Was this considered to be something that was glorious, or were there people who really opposed this and wanted to cling on to that sense of republic and revolution and change?
I mean, there are a small number of people who vehemently oppose Charles II, and that's including sort of, you know, the old servants of the Republic like John Lambert, who ends up getting thrown in prison, but also, you know, quite ordinary people, you know, say things like, why should we have a Scot on the throne when we had Cromwell, and there's definitely some opposition. Some of the religious radicals are opposed to the Restoration, but broadly speaking, the Restoration was very, very popular. We have to think about it in its immediate context, though, which is that Cromwell died in September 1658. There's then a period of a year and a half of political chaos. So although the vast majority of people definitely preferred Charles II to political chaos, it's a bit harder to say that they definitely preferred monarchy to republic in May 1660. But what I think we can say is that certainly by the time of the Restoration, royalism had managed to create an image for itself which was very, very popular. And that image hinged on things which were more difficult under the republics. And so that's things like, theatre, things like sport, things like maypoles, Morris dancing. It may amaze you to hear was actually an immensely politically radical and subversive act in the 1650s. It was very much a form of covert royalism. But also the Book of Common Prayer as well, which was actually quite popular. The rituals associated with the Anglican, church calendar were popular amongst people, and what the Republic had brought in to replace them was seen as very, very dry and very kind of, very unattractive in many, many ways. So in 1660, there's certainly a royalism which Charles is able to play upon. The trouble is that within a few years, although that sort of royalism never goes away, Charles had managed to, or at least his government had managed to create quite a lot of unnecessary problems. And one of the things that they do is they very quickly impose quite a strict religious code on the church. We call it the Clarendon Code after the Earl of Clarendon, although he himself was not particularly in favour of it. Charles II wasn't particularly in favour of it. The trouble is that he had a parliament full of sort of royalist hardliners who pushed for this church settlement. And that excluded a lot of quite moderate people who were not necessarily Episcopalian. They didn't necessarily agree with government by bishops. And it was very, very harsh on Quakers and very, very harsh on other forms of nonconformists. People looked at Charles and in particular they looked at his failures in the wars against the Dutch, particularly the Second Dutch War of 1660, in the mid 1660s, and they looked at that and they compared him to Cromwell, and they said, well, Cromwell made us feared across Europe, and Charles is just a bit of a joke, really, And then there's all the stuff about the sexual license at the court. I'm absolutely fascinated by royalists. I think for royalists are just as you may gather that some of my sympathy is with the sort of parliamentarian radicals, and I think that's probably true. But I find royalists absolutely fascinating as well. And in the 1650s, one of the things that the royalists do is they try and create this image for themselves as being kind of fun-loving libertines who like dancing and drinking and sleeping around and everything like that. Charles I would have found this horrifying. He was a very, very kind of conservative guy, quite straight laced. But that image of the roaring cavalier is one that sticks. But it loses quite a lot of support quite quickly for Charles's government once he's actually in power. Within a couple of years, the rumours going round about what's going on at court are quite damaging for Charles, because his court is seen as being full of reprobates, and that's never good. Say what you like about Cromwell, but you could never say that about his government. Upstarts maybe, horrendous Puritans perhaps, soldiers even worse, but they weren't reprobates in the way that Charles II's court were. So he managed to take this. I have to say, I find Charles an immensely frustrating individual. and Charles I has been really badly served by history, because obviously what happens. I actually think Charles I was a fairly decent guy. Obviously in the Second Civil War, he starts a war, a lot of people get killed, but I can see why he did that. Whereas Charles II, I just think is, I find him immensely frustrating. A much less attractive character than his father. Anyway, I digress. But the point is that within a few years, that restoration regime has actually lost quite a lot of support. So people actually start to look back and think, well, do you know what? That Cromwell, he wasn't so bad in so many ways.
Yeah, I do remember reading something. I think it was a source from the period, and it was all about some of these libertines and these cavaliers defecating because they were drunk and finding it absolutely hilarious. Or it was urinating off the balconies of taverns or something. And it was like, has much changed? I'm not really sure. However,
there's a very, very famous, a very infamous case which is referred to in Samuel Pepys's diary, where one a member of Charles's court basically he stands on a balcony in Covent Garden, I think it is.
Yeah, I think this is the one I'm talking about. about.
Yeah. He dips his knob in a glass of wine and then gives a mock sermon and you know, all kinds of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, you know, imagine looking at this as a sort of moderately serious London merchant with a, you know, a respectable wool export business. And you think, well, we're being ruled by these absolute, you know. And ironically enough, the guy who did that ended up being an opponent of the regime. He ended up being a Whig. He ended up being a kind of, you know, supporter of William of Orange. So, well, there you go. But yeah, I mean, you know, some people weren't as excited to be ruled by libertines as we might necessarily expect them to have been.
You mentioned William of Orange, and that's a very nice segue into summing up the 17th century. So William of Orange came about in the Glorious Revolution. What was the Glorious Revolution, and was it glorious, or did it hurl us into the 18th century in total disarray?
I don't think it was glorious. I mean, you know, you only have to look at the consequences in Ireland and Scotland to a point as well. And it's even less, I mean, you know, in England, we tend to see it as being a peaceful revolution. But that's only true to a point, in that it was accompanied by quite widespread outbreaks of anti-Catholic rioting. And there were a couple of kind of, albeit fairly desultory, skirmishes between the two armies when both William and James had armies in play. One way of interpreting the Glorious Revolution is to say that there's nothing fundamentally wrong about the English state, and that it's just because James II, Charles's brother, is completely hopeless. He alienates the people who should be supporting him, and then that leads to his political authority collapsing and William being invited over. And that's, I suppose, the sort of fashionable viewpoint. I actually think that what that underplays slightly is the fact that a lot of the problems of James II's reign are problems that have quite long standing pedigrees. And firstly, I would say that a lot of the problems that James has are inherited from his brother. And one in particular, which is that in the late 1670s, once it's become clear that James II is a Catholic, and once there are these completely fabricated allegations of a popish plot, you get a crisis in the English politics, which we call the exclusion crisis. It basically kind of pulls up a load of the old issues which were unsettled after the Civil War. Firstly, there's a question about religion and what do we do with Catholics, and who do dissenters support, and who should kind of Anglicans support. But secondly, there's that question of sovereignty, because the Whigs, so you get these kind of two political parties, the Whigs and the Tories, and the Whigs basically argue that in the name of protecting the country from a Catholic king, they should alter the laws of succession. So essentially you're arguing for the sovereignty of the people. At the same time, the Tories, who are their enemies, who are basically the kind of descendants of the royalists, are saying that you can't do this because power is divinely ordained by God. So again, it's those same issues. And B, we did this before in 1641, and look what happened. You got ruled by an horrible bunch of Puritans and the army, and Christmas was cancelled and all this kind of horrible stuff, and you couldn't have maypoles. So we absolutely shouldn't be doing this kind of thing now, because the Whigs are the direct heirs of the horrible roundheads. So all those issues get dredged up again. And here's the crucial thing. In order to get out of that crisis, which becomes very serious for a short period of time, Charles's only option, or the only option that he is able to see at least, is to massively side with one of those parties. And he sides with the Tories. And he's able to kind of basically use the apparatus of state to basically crush the Whigs for a period of time. And what that means is that by 1685, when Charles II dies, what had been in 1660 a sort of unifying monarchy, you know, a monarchy for all, albeit with, you know, with a few small exceptions, had become a party political monarchy. It was a Tory monarchy. rather than a restoration monarchy by 1685. And so that means that when James II comes to the throne and then alienates the Tories, he has no basis of support. There's no one who wants to support him, really. A very small number of people who want to support him. So you could argue that it's actually that legacy of Charles II, which is so problematic for James. But also, and I promise I'll stop rattling on in a second, many of the kind of longer term social issues which had destabilised things in the 1640s. So I'm thinking here about the growth of London, which is a location for protests. The growing kind of political consciousness of the middle sort of people, but also perhaps more fundamentally, the rise of the press and the rise of news culture, literacy, all that kind of thing. That means that it's that bit harder in the 1680s to hold on to a monarchy as a divine right ruler. So, as I say, whilst I think it's kind of fashionable amongst historians to really kind of focus on the short term, the accidents, the failings of James II, there's more long term stuff going on, I think, there. And so, yeah, what the Glorious Revolution, I don't think is especially glorious. It is an important step towards, I'm not going to say it's an important step towards democracy, but it's an important step in that long journey towards popular sovereignty. But it also, I think, it has longer term causes than some people would admit to.
Jonathan, you've done remarkably well at summarising.
I rattled on. Sorry, there's too much lecturer mode there, I think.
I feel like we could have taken one small point from some of the aspects of the century that you talked about and create an entire podcast just from that alone. I mean, I am quite convinced that the 17th century was a jam-packed century of social, political change, of revolution. And there's so much that we didn't even touch on. I'm conscious that we skimmed through, these big events like, I don't know, the Great Fire of London and the Great Plague. But, all of those little nuggets people could...
England's last ever famine was in the 17th century. Roots of the welfare state, all this kind of stuff. But still, we have 25 minutes, so...
Exactly. But people can look forward to that with your forthcoming book. Are you allowed to mention the title and roughly when it's going to be out?
It will be called either The Blazing World or A Blazing World, depending on... a debate in my head, but it should be out in around about this time next year, published by Bloomsbury and Knopf in the US.
That's so exciting, and how appropriate. Whichever title you go for is extremely appropriate, because it was certainly a blazing world and a lot of blazing topics to discuss. Thank you so much for coming on, and we'll have to look out for your book this time next year, hopefully in better circumstances.
Yeah. Yes. Well, thank you very much for having me. It's always fun to record these things and have an opportunity to gabble on.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.